You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we find out what one Wisconsin nonprofit is doing to provide assistance to people affected by this weekend's earthquake in Ecuador.
First, the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 ordered an end to racial segregation in American schools. But more than 60 years later, Milwaukee and other major cities still see high levels of segregation in their schools.
One question left open by that court decision was how schools should be desegregated. There were a number of approaches taken, but the one that captured public attention and media attention, especially in the North, was busing, transporting African-American students to mostly white schools. From the 1950s and the 1970s, busing became a major controversy. It was ultimately rejected by political leaders, from presidential candidate Ronald Reagan to then-Senator Joe Biden. Our next guest says in order to change segregation in today's schools, we need to take a closer look at why busing dominated that debate. Matthew Delmont joins us now. He's an associate professor of history at Arizona State University, and his latest book is Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into the story you tell in your book, why is it important to try to understand this whole busing controversy, now in 2016?
Well, I think we live with many of the problems that emerged from the busing controversy of the 1970s. Our schools are still largely segregated on the basis of race and socioeconomic status. But I don't think most people understand what was attempted with busing in the first place and why there was so much resistance to it. So in trying to do this research, I was trying to really ground our contemporary policy debates in a firm story about what actually happened historically.
Well, how do we get from Brown versus the Board of Education to busing as the centerpiece of desegregation of schools?
Well, busing comes up as a court-ordered way to force school districts that have been recalcitrant, that have resisted school desegregation, to force them to take some sort of meaningful steps to integrate their schools. So the language of busing actually emerges as a way to resist school desegregation efforts. So most people associate busing with BOSS in the 1970s, but busing actually starts as a term that gets debated politically in the 1950s in New York. And it starts with a group of white parents who are opposed to the idea of black and Puerto Rican students being sent from minority schools to schools in white neighborhoods in Queens. So we actually have this language of busing, this opposition to busing emerging before school districts are really considering busing as a meaningful tactic. But then when you start to see court orders in the 1970s in Boston, eventually in Milwaukee, busing is being used as a way to try to force these school districts to make some sort of meaningful steps to integrate their schools.
Yeah, and you write that before what we now think of as busing started, actually often black students were being bused away from white districts. And that didn't get that kind of level of national controversy.
Exactly. So throughout the book, I actually use the term busing in quotation marks, because I think once busing becomes a political term, it misses the fact that buses had been used for generations in American schools. And actually, school buses are what make possible the modern American school districts that we still know today. It makes possible having larger, comprehensive high schools, makes possible for students to be able to travel distances from their rural schools to suburban and urban schools. And in fact, buses had been used to maintain school segregation in the years before the Brown decision and the years immediately following. So the language of busing as a way to oppose school desegregation misses the fact that school buses were used for a variety of purposes, but also to, in some cases, maintain segregated schools.
Talking to Matthew Delmont, he's the author of the new book, Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. Let's get to this battle that didn't start, but really erupted in many ways in the 1970s. Matthew, the civil rights movement, we think of as a Southern issue in a lot of ways, but this busing story and this school desegregation story we're talking about here, in most ways, it seems like it was an urban Northern phenomenon.
It was. And I think one of the things that was hard for people to recognize in these northern cities was that segregation, racism, was not just a Southern issue. It wasn't something that was just happening in Little Rock and Selma and Montgomery, but it was happening in Boston and Chicago and New York. And there were grassroots civil rights movements in each of those cities, and in Milwaukee as well, that they were there for decades before the 1970s. But the school districts that become the dominant stories for busing are all these northern districts, because they're the ones that hold out the longest in terms of doing anything about integrating their schools. Boston becomes the most famous example, because the Boston School Committee there, led at times by Luis de Hicks, who becomes a kind of a figurehead of the white backlash, they resist any meaningful efforts for over two decades to address school segregation in the city. So by the time Judge Arthur Garrity makes the decision in Boston in 1974 that it's going to be busing, the school district, the school board at that point had already resisted doing anything for years, and that's part of the reason it emerges as this crisis story. And I think one of the problems I have with how people remember that Boston story is that the story in Boston was really the fact that the schools had been intentionally segregated, and the court order was meant to address that fact. But people tend to focus just on the fact that there was a tremendous amount of anger and animosity about the busing order itself, but that misses what was going on in the two decades before 1974.
Yeah, a lot of the story you tell in this book is how busing was framed, and you say the way the debate was made, the arguments were made, and the way the media presented them, it turned it from the civil rights of black children to the preferences of white parents. How did that happen?
It happened in two ways. One, the people who were opposed to school desegregation in the North, these are white parents and politicians, they were very close students of the African-American civil rights movement. So whereas television played a really positive role in terms of framing African-American civil rights, particularly the Southern movement, and bringing that to a national audience, by the 1960s and 70s, you have primarily white parents who are against busing getting a lot of positive news coverage. And that's because they're framing their opposition to busing in a language, in a set of protest tactics that look very much like the Southern movement. So having large-scale public protests with a lot of women and children and American flags, clearly marked placards. And I think most importantly, they never say that they're opposed to sending their kids to school with black or Puerto Rican or Latino students. What they say is we're in favor of neighborhood schools. We're trying to protect our rights. These are our civil rights that they're fighting for. That language resonated really powerfully through the media and helped to make their case against busing. From the media's perspective, they gave a lot of positive coverage to these white parents because for a lot of the northern media locations, whether it's the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, or the national broadcast networks, they just couldn't believe that segregation could exist in these northern cities. So they never thought of civil rights in the North as being as morally urgent of an issue as it was in the South. So when it came time to cover these issues when they came north, they were working from a very fuzzy understanding of what racism looked like in their own cities, and therefore they covered the issue in a way that was more favorable to the people who were opposing school desegregation.
Yeah, you put a lot of attention to the TV media in particular at the time, and whereas in the Southern Civil Rights Movement, there was a lot of focus on the individual black students, the Little Rock Nine, you know, still live on in legend, and very little, you write, in fact, some left on the cutting room floor when it came to African-American students in the North in these desegregation battles.
Yeah, one of the interesting things for me in working on this project is I watched hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage of how the nightly news broadcasts on ABC, CBS, and NBC covered these stories. And what was amazing to me is all of this footage, hours and hours and hours of it, focus on white parents and white neighborhoods that are angry about busing, and you see just a few seconds, a few short clips of the black students whose rights were actually at stake in these cases. And I think part of what was going on is that the white parents who were opposed to busing, they were the most forthright in their complaints. They offered the best sound bites. They had the best sort of media personas that were attractive to television news broadcasts. They made the story compelling to viewers. Whereas by the 1970s, I think there was a sense that the African-American civil rights story had sort of run its course. It wasn't interesting to viewers in the same way. So what TV ended up doing was talking more about the backlash among white parents rather than focusing on who were these black students who were being bused and what were the sort of constitutional issues that were at stake. I mean, because fundamentally, busing was about the constitutional rights of black students, but it ended up being framed about the anger and frustration of white parents.
Would you say that busing, in effect, became a code word for a northern form of discrimination, of intentional racism?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that was interesting for me in doing the research is understanding how that very language got written into things like the Civil Rights Act. So when the 1964 Civil Rights Act is being debated, the northern, midwestern, and western senators, they explicitly include language that defines segregation as being something that's occurring in the South, and it defines what they call racial imbalance in the North as being something that the federal government is not going to pursue. That matters because it ends up being the case that the federal authorities turn their attention to southern school districts, but it leaves the school districts in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, and lets them off the hook because they're defining segregation as being something that doesn't exist in those cities. That's a problem. It ends up being false that there was intentional segregation in many of these cities, but the laws were written in such a way that it made it incredibly difficult to prosecute those cases.
We're talking to Matthew Delmont. He's an associate professor of history at Arizona State University, and we're talking about his latest book. It's called Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Were you a part of this debate over school desegregation and busing back in the 1970s? What did you think about it then? And today, is your school district heavily segregated or not? And what's the solution to modern-day school segregation? Call 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we continue our conversation now with Matthew Delmont, Associate Professor of History at Arizona State University. His latest book is called Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you part of the debate over school desegregation, over busing back in the 70s? Is this an issue in your life now, in your local school, in your community? Is your local school still really segregated? What, if anything, should we be doing about that? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go right to our callers now. Carrie is on the line with us in Milwaukee. Carrie, hi.
Hello, this is Carrie. I'm calling because in my neighborhood, which is a very diverse neighborhood, my daughter, we chose to send her to our actual neighborhood school, but a lot of our neighbors choose to send their children to maybe a Montessori school or a less diverse school, and I just think that people don't understand the benefits of sending their kids to urban schools that are diverse, and I think it's just still really a problem, and that she's really benefiting from going to the school, and people just don't understand that.
Carrie, thanks for that call. And private schools, Matthew, I know that was part of a lot of communities' answer to desegregation. I know in the South, I don't know about the North, is new private schools opened up. Was that part of the story you were looking into?
Yeah, it's a small part of the story I tell that, particularly in the South, you had a wave of private schools opening up, what they ended up calling, critics ended up calling segregation academies as a way for parents who opposed school desegregation efforts and who had the resources to be able to send their kids to private schools to send them to these largely white private schools. You see some of that in the North, but it really is a Southern phenomenon.
Carrie, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Marlon in Madison. Marlon, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Marlon?
Oh, well, I participated in two different periods of the busing program in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm actually a school teacher in Madison, Wisconsin, currently. And so when I first participated in the busing program, I was in second grade. And I initially started the school year going to, at the time it was called Victor Berger Elementary School. And then there was lots of interest in sending kids out to suburban schools. And so when we were asked by our family if me and some of my friends would like to go to this school, we were saying, sure. They were saying it's all about integration. We didn't even know what integration was, but we thought it was cool. So when we got to school on our first day, we were picketed by all the neighbors out there. And so we didn't realize that when we got there, we weren't actually going to be mixed in the classrooms with white kids, and we weren't. We were all separated. So it was two buses. One bus of black students went into one classroom, and then my bus and our kids in our bus went into a second separate classroom with also all blacks only.
And Marlon, you said that was your first experience with busing. What was your second?
Right. And that was at Grantosa, 82nd Street School on 82nd and Grantosa in Milwaukee. My second experience was, I was much older when I was in high school, and I was with the 220 busing program, and I caught the bus out to Bayview High School. It would take me a long time to get to school. It would take me about an hour and a half one way. But I loved it because it was part of the magnet program that Milwaukee schools had. I don't know if they still do because I've been in Madison for 21 years now.
Marlon, thanks a lot for sharing your stories. I want to bring Matthew Delmont back into this now. So sounds like Marlon was part of what I think might have been unique in Milwaukee, this intact busing program. Can you talk about that, Matthew?
Sure, yeah, I'm glad the caller mentioned that. So Milwaukee was unique in having this program they called Intact Busing, which meant, just as your caller described, they sent African-American students from predominantly black schools and black neighborhoods to white schools, but the students weren't actually integrated in those schools. They were in separate classrooms, in some cases separate lunchrooms, separate recess times. So it was kind of a bizarre scenario where they are counted as integration in terms of the demographics of the overall school, but the experience itself was not at all integrated. But I think Milwaukee is also interesting, as the caller mentioned, that it did have some success with magnet school programs. It had some success with vouchers, but also the sense that all the research that we have about these school segregation efforts is once they were given a chance to actually work, they worked to the benefit of black students, and they usually did not negatively impact white students at all. It did often put the onus on black students to travel a great distance from their home, but the students who went through the programs, the scholars who have studied this, have found it had long-term benefits in terms of the educational opportunities and the long-term life chances of African-American students.
Marlon mentioned being picketed when he and his classmates arrived at these white schools. But you also write that civil rights activists were protesting this because it was this still a separate classroom within this other school.
Yeah, it was exactly the opposite of what civil rights activists wanted to see happen. They wanted black students to be transported to schools with better resources and have an integrated experience, not to be transported and sort of make the kind of southern model of Jim Crow evident in a Milwaukee school where you have a white classroom and a black classroom. So it was exactly what they did not want to see happen. And the kind of picketing that your caller was talking about, people often ask, what did African Americans think about busing? And honestly, it was a complicated set of emotions because in many cases, students were being transported to neighborhoods and schools where they encountered hostility and racism. So in many cases, African Americans ended up lobbying more for resources back to African American schools to not have to go into these hostile environments.
Marlon, thanks for that call. We're talking to Matthew Delmont, Associate Professor of History at Arizona State University. His newest book is Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. Go to another caller now with Jim on the line in Winchester. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just want to say I was a elementary school in the 70s. I went to Wilson and Wilson and Hawthorne. My parents moved into that neighborhood specifically because of the distances. It was less than a block to Wilson, two blocks to Hawthorne, and a mile to East. And I can remember my parents fighting the busing because, if I remember correctly, it was going to be the same number of students would have to leave our school that were being bused in. I don't ever remember implementation of this, but I do remember the fights that my parents would go to the PTA meetings and that they were trying to stop the kids from going out. That was their main concern, is the whole reason they moved to this neighborhood was to be in close proximity to these schools.
Jim, thanks for that call. And did it work out that way, Matthew, that as students, black students were being bused into white schools, white students were being bused elsewhere?
It depended on the community. In some places, there were mostly one-way busing programs. We had African-American students bused to white schools. In many cases, those were protested as well. The white parents didn't want black students coming into their schools, even if it was a one-way program. But the more contentious programs were two-way busing efforts. And I think, as your caller mentioned, these were controversial because they impacted where people lived and what they perceived to be their rights as homeowners and as parents to send their kids to the closest schools. And they caused some inconvenience to people. I think the challenge it forced people to sort of deal with was how to share the question of opportunities and burdens with regards to education across a citywide level. And the problem with a lot of the residential basis for school decisions was so much of our residential housing patterns were based on discriminatory housing practices in the first place, that the tying schools directly to where people could live ended up reinforcing a lot of discriminatory practices from the past.
Time for one more call. Justine in Milwaukee is with us now. Justine, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to give you a quick call and give you my input. I was actually a part of busing back in the 70s. My family and I moved from a suburb of Milwaukee back into Milwaukee to take care of my grandmother. And so I was bused to a school that required a 45-minute ride from where I lived to the school, a bus ride to the school every day. And while I would say that I learned a lot about different cultures and how to accept people. I mean, I grew up where color wasn't an issue, so it wasn't a big difference. But I will say that most of the time in the classroom was spent dealing with the conflict between the two races. So I remember a lot of issues that happened that year with the different races. Mm-hmm. I don't remember anything that I learned in that school.
Justine, thanks for that call. A little low on time now. Matthew, was this a common people reporting conflict in the classroom?
Again, that kind of varied by community. So in many cases, you did see a lot of conflicts. In part, that's some communities did a better job than others in terms of preparing students, teachers, and communities for the stresses that desegregation was going to bring. And I think the larger point is that this was a lot to ask of communities, and it's something that was worthy to ask of them, that we had built a system of school segregation in the country over a period of decades, and it needed more than just a few years to work effectively.
Matthew, just in our last minute, we still have a lot of segregated districts today. In your work, what one lesson do you think we should pull out of what you've been talking about to try to solve these problems today?
The main lesson is that school segregation has never been accidental. It was a set of policy choices with regards to school zoning, school science, student assignment, and school funding. If we want to have a different set of outcomes with regards to school segregation in the present, we can make a different set of policy choices with those issues.
Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Matthew Delmont. He's an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. And we've been looking at his latest book. It's called Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation.
Coming up, a look at the Ecuadorian earthquake through the eyes of one Wisconsinite with a long history of working in that country. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.